Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Labor Day weekend with an analysis of where the labor movement stands and speak with Dr. Holly Shaken, who studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We'll discuss gains made by labor in California and the upcoming open convention of the AFL-CIO. Then, in contrast to the flat and falling wages for working Americans, we'll look into the scandal of CEO pay and how corporate heads who either preside over massive failures and losses, are engaged in fraud and deception, or are bailed out by the taxpayer, the bailed out, the booted, or the busted, are rewarded. Veteran labor journalist Sam Pizzagatti joins us to discuss the new report released by the Institute for Policy Studies. He co-authored the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report that examines the performance of 241 corporate chief executives. Then finally, we'll speak with longtime labor and social justice activist Bill Fletcher Jr., a columnist for BlackCommentator.com and author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. We'll discuss this week's celebration of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington in the context of divorcing civil rights from economic justice and how the American right uses the success of having a black president and a black attorney general against minorities as an excuse for rolling back voting rights. And joining us now is Dr. Holly Shaken, who is a professor in the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Holly Shaken.
Very nice to be here.
And of course, on Labor Day, we often lament the decline of labor and down to something like 7% of the private workforce overall, about 11% of the workforce. But my understanding is that next week, the AFL-CIO are going to hold their first ever open convention. What will that mean?
I think we're going to see a lot of ideas at that open convention. The AFL-CIO is working very hard to reinvent itself at a critical moment. As you mentioned, the numbers are really grim for labor. I think virtually everyone in the labor movement is aware of that. Labor nationally in the U.S. lost 400,000 members last year. It's down to about 11.3% of the workforce overall, 6.6% in the private workforce. So labor is making a real effort to introduce a lot of new approaches to really reinvent itself for the period in which we're in. And I think we're going to see some important signs of that at the AFL-CIO convention in Los Angeles, beginning with the fact that it's an open convention.
Well, in terms of the public, it's very clear that the Republican Party and their corporate backers don't like labor. That goes without saying. But a recent Pew poll says that 51% of Americans hold favorable views of labor unions. And that's happening, I think, in spite of an enormous vilification of labor that has taken place by the well-funded opponents of labor.
There's been really an unprecedented onslaught against labor, again, seeking to portray labor as a special interest, a very narrow special interest, and truly to demonize it for any economic problems that we faced as a society. But the fact that the Pew poll shows that over half of Americans polled really do have a favorable impression of labor, even under these circumstances, is, I think, a real tribute of what labor has done historically, but also that unions play a real role. So even if you're not a union member, for whatever reason, there's a sense that unions do represent broader worker interest and the broader interest of the disadvantaged, the vulnerable, the marginalized in a society.
And, of course, here in the state of California, again, California is bucking the national trend. Union membership in California has increased by 110,000 in 2012, while it fell by 368,000 nationwide. So what's California doing in the sense that quite often California sets national trends? Could this be a turnaround?
There's a much brighter picture in California. As you mentioned, California gained over 100,000 members last year. There's not a single explanation for this. There's very effective leadership on a statewide level. There's a number of unions in the state that have been very aggressive in organizing. There's the recovery of the state economy that's bringing people back to work, particularly public workers. So you've got all of that going on, but one key dimension of it is unions have reached out to the immigrant community in very innovative, very forceful ways. And that's beginning to pay real dividends. They've marched with immigrants. They've organized with immigrants. They've organized immigrants into the labor movement. And all of that positions California in a critical way with the key demographic in the state, soon to be the largest single ethnic group in the state. I think labor is paying, gaining some important dividends as a result of that.
So in terms of these bills that are being passed in the legislatures, New York and Hawaii, bills of rights for workers, particularly domestic workers, we know about the slave wages that Walmart pays and how the workers at Walmart have to use public services, the taxpayers' money, to subsidize what normally corporations would be paying for, health care and a livable wage. So is that a positive trend here?
I think it is. I think it's meant to extend labor's reach to particularly vulnerable workers. And labor is experimenting with all kinds of new approaches, including at Walmart's, where you have unions involved in groups that are seeking to protest the low wages in Walmart's and fast food restaurants, and where thousands of workers across the country have participated in short strikes to dramatize the fact that someone might be 48 years old, work 10 years somewhere at a fast food restaurant, and still makes $8 an hour. Is that the verge of unionization? Not that close today, but it's putting something on the agenda that's absolutely critical and could lead to changes down the road.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Now, in terms of these various trade deals, loosely under the heading of globalization, there's now the new Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement being negotiated now. We've had NAFTA. And there is, of course, a paradox here on the political right, where the Tea Party right wing talk about an assault on our sovereignty by UN black helicopters and the idea that there's some movement going on somewhere, some nefarious movement towards world government. So you have that mindset. But within the Republican Party, you also have this other mindset that seems to believe that global trade and relaxing rules for workers and conditions and standards is inevitable. That's just the new economic reality. I remember hearing a Republican congressman once say, it's a global world out there. So can you explain that paradox?
Well, it's certainly a very real paradox between business elements of the Republican Party that very much want to see an expansion of global trade and elements of the Republican Party that are very powerful, such as some of the Tea Party groups, that view any expansion of trade as sort of diminishing U.S. sovereignty, et cetera, and take a very xenophobic view of engaging with the rest of the world. That's something that is plaguing the Republican Party. For the Democrats, though, I think global trade, as most unions feel, can be a very positive thing. The issue becomes not expanding trade, but the rules under which it's done. And what we've seen in recent decades is expanding trade at the expense of workers rather than making working families its beneficiary. So the notion of having rules and trade agreements that guarantee intellectual property rights is widely accepted, although sometimes controversial because it pushes that too far. Rules for protecting workers' rights have been anemic at best, and the result is trade itself is hobbled because the flip side of realizing the gains of trade is expanded purchasing power, and that doesn't occur in a robust way if workers can't bargain effectively to raise their wages. So the issue isn't globalization itself, it's the rules of the game and trade agreements that diminish what workers can do rather than expand the gains for working families.
But Harley Shaken, we saw after the passage of NAFTA that the peasant farmers in Mexico basically were wiped out because there's no way that these third world countries can compete with agribusiness and the highly mechanized and chemicalized agribusiness here in the United States with enormous productive capacity and can sell, you know, grains at a fraction of what the ajito, the poor Mexican farmer on a marginal piece of land, can eke out. So how do you navigate between the power of and the productivity of corporate agriculture versus third world agriculture? Is there a balance that can be struck here? Because essentially what happened in Mexico was the entire rural poor literally marched with their feet across the border.
I think you're raising an excellent point. There's no easy answer here, but there are far better paths, and there are worse paths. With NAFTA, when NAFTA was passed, over one out of every five people in the Mexican economy earned their living on the land. Now, it's one thing to say, okay, we're going to have a transition over a period of years, and we're going to provide new opportunities in industry and other sectors of the economy for people that are displaced on the land, and quite another simply to displace people and say, well, this itself is progress. So it really requires broader and far more effective public policies and a focus on a transition that leads many people to have jobs in other areas of the economy. In Mexico, it was a transition, but for many, it was a transition into complete marginalization or immigration out of the country itself. And that didn't take into account, you know, the powerful forces of having small peasant farmers with few resources compete against large agribusiness, often heavily subsidized in the U.S. and elsewhere.
So, Harley Shaken, you mentioned Walmart, and of course Walmart's become the poster boy for anti-labor and almost slave wages. Walmart's 1.4 million domestic retail employees make an average of $8.81 per hour. And this has led even Walmart's chief financial officer to recently say that American workers simply do not have enough money to spend on the company's merchandise, and which is explaining why there has been a decline in sales. Now, that, of course, harks back to what Henry Ford said, that you have to pay your workers enough to buy your product. Have American capitalists completely forgot that idea?
I think they haven't completely forgotten that idea, but they certainly haven't put it at front and center of what this economy is going to need going forward. 70% of this economy is essentially consumption. So the flip side of low wages or declining wages is low purchasing power. So what may work very well for any single company, say Walmart, paying $8.81 an hour, is a disaster if all companies pay $8.81 an hour, because it diminishes our purchasing power, it throttles the recovery, and it results in the kind of stagnation that we've been witnessing in recent years. So the notion of putting this front and center isn't simply a question of enlightenment of corporate America. It's a question of countervailing forces that are putting it there. And historically, in this country, unions have played that role. And on this Labor Day, I think that's something very important to recognize. It isn't simply a question of union leaders or even union members, but rather that in this economy, at its peak performance, domestically and globally, we had a strong labor movement that served to link strong advances in productivity into higher wages and benefits, and into a growing economy. We've lost that linkage. We've seen productivity continue to rise. We've seen wages stagnant or declining. And the result is a drag on economic growth. And that, I think, is of great concern to all Americans, union members or not.
But surely, Ali Shaikin, there's a fundamental question here about fairness, economic fairness and opportunity versus unlimited and voracious greed. If you consider that we're talking about the people who work for Walmart, the 1.4 million people who are paid an average of $8.81 per hour, and that's less than what you pay undocumented workers here in Los Angeles to work on your garden or something, or clean your house, you know. So it's really an amazing and profound disgrace. Yet the heirs to Walmart, the children, through the accident of birth, ended up inheriting Sam Walton's fortune that's grown extraordinary to the point where the heirs to the Walmart fortune, their combined wealth is the equivalent of the combined wealth of 40% of the lower 40% of the United States, just one family. Now, I don't understand why you can't people don't make that connection. Workers not having a living wage working for Walmart, and the heirs just piling up billions and billions, which they simply can't spend. And for God knows what reason, why do they need more money? And why can't they kick back a little bit of this money and make the lives of their workers a little more livable?
Well, I think this really gets back to that core notion. Slowly over decades, by demonizing labor, by weakening the role of unions in the economy and in the society, we wound up with a situation where there isn't a countervailing force to effectively challenge this. All that said, unions still play a critical role in raising these issues, the notion of what's happened to inequality in this society. We've never been an equal society. That's not the issue. But what we're experiencing now, and you're mentioning this in the context of Walmart, is hyper inequality. And that isn't simply an abstraction. It's something that absolutely diminishes opportunity, diminishes how one's children can advance in the society, and creates real constraints that ultimately can corrode democracy itself. So these are huge issues. We didn't get here overnight, but the notion of a strong, growing labor movement being able to present a different perspective on this is very healthy, in fact, essential to the checks and balances of any democratic society.
So, Ali Shaikin, then in the last couple of minutes, in terms of good news, we started out, and my caveat, of course, in the beginning was that we normally, when we talk about labor on Labor Day, we always acknowledge the decline of labor. And now we're talking about a possible change here with the AFL-CIO's open convention this coming week. And at least the National Labor Relations Board now has all five members seated. The Republicans have basically frustrated that for years and years. And finally, that was the deal that Obama made. Will that make a difference?
I think it will. And I think leadership from the president could make an important difference. It's going to be limited in all kinds of ways, given where the Congress is on many of these issues. But just the combination of a full NLRB with people that are intent on enforcing labor law in this country and seeking to guarantee workers the right to choose or not to choose a union, I think that's going to be an important step forward. And leadership from the Oval Office could be critical. I think when we look at the reasons for some optimism in admittedly a very tough set of circumstances. The circumstances haven't changed overnight. They're not receding as a result of this Labor Day. But I think the cause for optimism we've seen on the ground in the last year or so, with a lot of very new, very innovative efforts and a sense of urgency that labor leaders feel that the current status quo is absolutely unacceptable and labor has to be turned around. The linkage of labor and social movements, Rich Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, has really stressed this in recent months, the notion that labor is part of a broader movement to improve American society that ranges from the Sierra Club to the NAACP to the involvement with church groups on issues such as immigration or living standards, the involvement with community groups. All that is taking place on the ground, and I think there's cause for some very cautious optimism that some of these efforts are going to take hold. Not all of them by any means, but there are things happening that are very visible, some of which that have displayed important success. And in the state of California, things could be much better for labor, but there have already been very important gains, starting with the 100,000-plus members gained last year and a percentage of the workforce of union members that begins to approach one out of every five workers in California is in a union. So you've got these kinds of developments that are out there within a context where there are still very powerful and in some cases growing forces arrayed against labor.
Well, Dr. Holly Shaken, I thank you so much for joining us here on this Labor Day weekend.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Holly Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We can take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the scandal of CEO pay.
I work for the union because she's so good to me.
Get ready to cause, just like Humpty Dumpty. I'm going to fall, and I'm sitting on top of the world. I'm rolling along, yes, rolling along. Don't want any million, I'm getting my share. I've only got one suit, just one, that's all I can wear. A bundle of money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on this Labor Day weekend is Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is an editor at the online newsletter Too Much, and he's the author of a new report released Wednesday by the Institute for Policy Studies, the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you.
And the annual, and this is the 20th annual anniversary executive excess report, which came out this Wednesday, lists the CEOs of, in the United States, 241 corporate chief executives who were ranked among America's 25 highest paid CEOs for one or more of the past 20 years. And the categories are, and shall we go through the categories, or just in general, tell me why you feel that's necessary, particularly when we're focusing on Labor Day weekend about the state of American labor, why are we talking about the CEOs? I think I know the answer, which is that they're outrageously paid compared to the workers.
Yes, and they've gotten outrageously paid by implementing policies that have hurt workers. They've gotten fantastically rich by downsizing, by outsourcing, by turning full-time jobs into part-time jobs, by rolling back pension and other benefits, by freezing wages, by refusing to pay decent wages in the first place. And they've taken all these actions because all these actions fatten the corporate bottom line, and their compensation is based on that bottom line. So there's a really good reason to talk about CEO compensation on Labor Day.
And now, In terms of the 40% of the top performing CEOs that were either bailed out, booted out, or busted, let's deal with the booted out. My understanding is that in spite of their poor performances, the CEOs who were booted out, their golden parachutes are valued at an average of $48 million. Is that?
Yes. Yes. These booted out CEOs occupied 14% of the 500 slots on our list, and they did walk away with average golden parachutes of $47.7 million. So that's quite a bit for people who've been fired from their jobs.
And in terms of the busted, they're the ones that ended up, you know, charged and fined and had to settle for breaking the law. Give us some examples there, because I understand, you know, that even bigger payments have been shelled out for some of these people.
Yes. We looked at 19 of CEOs in this category. 18 of their corporations shelled out over $100 million each in fines or penalties. Yet these CEOs were made out like bandits. So, for instance, former Bristol Myers Squibb CEO Charles Heinbold, who later became George Bush's ambassador to Sweden, he received $450 million and never returned any of his compensation. His company paid $450 million in fines, and Heinbold never returned any of the compensation that he received.
And what did he get fined for?
He got fined for accounting fraud. Bristol Myers was found liable for all sorts of accounting frauds. In other words, under his leadership, Bristol Squibb cooked the books, and that's a very common phenomenon that we've seen in corporate America.
Well, of course, we have the example of the governor of Florida, who, I think, didn't he pay the biggest fine in corporate America, $1.7 billion for fraud, defrauding the government and defrauding Medicare?
Yes, he used to run one of the biggest private profit-making hospital chains in the United States,
and he's
which paid an enormous penalty.
And he was rewarded by the voters in Florida, and they made him governor.
That's right. After he shelled out a ton for a massive advertising campaign that whitewashed his image.
Right. So let's move on through your list here, Sam Pizzagatti, of the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report to the Men's Club, which, of course, indicates how few women are in corporate America. There was an interesting study recently indicating that a majority of households now, I'm not sure it's a majority, I think maybe up to 40% to 50, close to 50%, of the households in the United States are now headed by a woman who's the primary breadwinner. So that's what's happening in the level of working Americans in the middle class. But at the top, the glass ceiling is well intact, is it not?
That's right. The CEO, the highly paid CEO club, is almost all male. In fact, only four women over the past 20 years have appeared in one of the annual lists of the most highly paid top 25 CEOs, only four over those 20 years. So what we're talking about here when we talk about the most highly paid CEOs is most definitely a purely men's club.
And the four women, how are they doing? I mean, is there...
Well, they're taking off after the men on the list. They're no great shakes in terms of what they're doing for working people in the United States. So, for instance, Carol Bartz over at Yahoo, during her short tenure there, she slashed 4% of the tech firm's workforce. In 2009, her first year on the job, she walked off with $45 million in compensation. She ended up getting fired 2 years later.
Where do you get jobs like that, Sam?
Well, that's, you get them all the time in the chief executive suites of corporate America.
I see. So let's then talk about the billion-dollar club.
Yes. There are several CEOs who have made, in their annual CEO compensation, who have made over $1 billion over the past 20 years. Some of those names, well, actually all three of the names are quite familiar. Larry Ellison, who's the CEO at Oracle, who's now the corporate mover and shaker behind the America's Cup yacht races going on in San Francisco. Sanford Weill, the former Citigroup CEO. And, of course, Michael Eisner, the Disney CEO. All of them have made over $1 billion just in annual compensation.
And, of course, in terms of Larry Ellison, that's small change, right?
That's small change. He's now, depending on the list, the third or fourth most wealthy billionaire in the world.
So, Sam Pezzagalli, let's then move on the 20th anniversary executive excess report list. Let's go to the next category, the taxpayer trough club.
Yes. Well, I think this piece of it may be the most galling piece of all, that a number of the CEOs that we looked at on our 20 years worth of most highly paid CEO list, a number of the CEOs get their money by doing business with the government. Now, Americans really get upset when elected officials are getting rich at our expense. But we have these corporate CEOs who are getting far, far richer at our expense. The CEOs of defense contractors like Lockheed Martin, United Technologies, IBM, General Electric, Honeywell. These companies are rewarding their CEOs at incredibly high levels, and have been doing this over the past 20 years. 12% of the 500 slots that we looked over the last 20 years are occupied by CEOs who essentially depend on tax dollars for all the business, or the major portion of the business their companies do.
So they have socialized losses and capitalist gains, right? And they have the best of both worlds. They have cost plus socialism, so they get guaranteed bottom line covered, and then the government pays them a guaranteed profit.
That's right. So we look at a company like Lockheed Martin. 82% of the revenues that Lockheed Martin now takes in on an annual basis come from the federal government, and a huge proportion of what's left come from state governments and other governmental bodies. Over the past 20 years, five times Lockheed Martin has had its CEO on the top 25 list, the annual top 25 list.
So have you looked into this new phenomenon where this other raid on the Treasury, because the military-industrial complex has been raiding the Treasuries for decades throughout the Cold War, and more recently the contractor wing of the or an adjunct to the military-industrial complex, the contractors, they've been raising the Treasury, and now you have, on top of that, you have the terrorism-industrial complex that came after 9/11. They've been also raiding the Treasury. And now, following the Edward Snowden revelations, you also have the intelligence industrial complex. 70% of intelligence has now been privatized. So all of those, they're bad enough. But there's a new phenomenon that I've been covering lately, Sam Pizzagatti, and that is these for-profit colleges that are a complete ripoff. And even just a few days ago, the president, in a Q&A in Scranton, Pennsylvania, when he was out touting his program to lower college costs, was asked a question about these colleges, and he had acknowledged that there's some really bad actors there. But they get all of their money from the taxpayer. They get these young students, minority kids, vets. They get federal dollars, and they charge these loans back to these kids for exorbitant interest rates, and then give them a worthless diploma if they even graduate, and they're saddled with a lifetime of debt. But at the same time, these CEOs, all of whom are entirely existing on federal money, are writing themselves massive paychecks. It's an extraordinary racket.
That's absolutely right. And what you've just described is a pattern of parasitic behavior. CEOs are supposed to add value to their enterprises, and their enterprises are supposed to add value to the economy. But I think what we see when we look at the CEOs of defense contractors, of private higher ed diploma mills, when we look at all these sorts of people, they're not adding any value. They're extracting value from the economy. They're extracting value from taxpayers. They're extracting value from exploited students. This is not the sort of economy that makes sense for average working Americans.
So how does this system of inflated paychecks for these CEOs who, whether they perform well or badly, it doesn't seem to matter, they still get enormous payoffs. How does that translate, for example, in terms of, you mentioned being parasitic. One of the things that I find extraordinary is that one of the richest corporations in the United States is Walmart, and
yes,
they pay their people so poorly that most of them have to, you know, rely on state and federal public assistance for food and health care, etc. So the taxpayers end up having to supplement the Walmart employees' salaries. But at the same time, as they screw their workers, I don't know how much they compensate their CEOs, but the family that owns most of the stock, the Walton family, the heirs, and most of whom purely as an accident of birth ended up in this position, they talk about no value added. Apparently the family combined, their combined wealth represents the equivalent of the bottom 40% of all Americans. Is that?
Yes, and here's another statistic on that. At the end of last week, Bloomberg News calculates on a weekly basis the wealth of the billionaires of the leading billionaires of the world. At the end of last week, four of the 12 richest people in the world were heirs to the Walton, to the Sam Walton Walmart fortune. Four of the top 12, a third of the richest dozen people in the world, owe their wealth to the Walmart empire.
And why do they need all of this money, more and more of it, at the expense of the very people who create that wealth for them, their workers?
Well, of course, there's no rational reason why they need more wealth. There's no rational reason why Larry Ellison pays himself $80-90 million every year from Oracle, the corporation he runs, when he's already one of the world's richest men. There's no rational reason. These huge paychecks, these huge fortunes, represent a power grab more than anything else. And until the power equation changes in the U.S. polity and the U.S. economy, we're going to continue to see this. But I think there's some good news here for Labor Day, and that is that a century ago we had a situation very similar today. We had a situation where average working people were creating enormous wealth, and that wealth was being siphoned off by a precious few, by a very, very small elite in the United States. But 50 years later, in the middle of the 20th century, that plutocracy that existed at the beginning of the 20th century had essentially been smashed, and America had become the first mass middle-class nation in the history of the world. Now, of course, in the years since then, particularly the last 30 years, that's eroded, and we have a plutocracy again. But we beat that plutocracy once. Why can't we beat it again? I think we can, and I know we must.
Well, Sam Pizzagatti, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, who's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and is the author of a new report released by the Institute for Policy Studies last Wednesday, the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a longtime labor and social justice activist, Bill Fletcher, Jr.
The grocers, though we have fun. Tax collectors getting closer. still we have fun. There's nothing surer. The rich get rich and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul, tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bill Fletcher Jr., a longtime Labor, racial justice, and international activist. He is an editorial board member and columnist for BlackCommentator.com and a senior scholar for the Institute for Policy Studies. Bill Fletcher is the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor, and A New Path Towards Social Justice. And he has an article at the Zinn Educational Project, Claiming and Teaching the 1963 March on Washington. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Fletcher, Jr.
Glad to be on board.
And this week, of course, we saw the 50th anniversary of the famous March on Washington, and so much focus has been on that, as well as the paradox of celebrating Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream at the same time going to war with Syria, but that notwithstanding. What did you take away from this week?
I think that this was a missed opportunity, actually. I think that it was important to commemorate the March on Washington, but the problem was that the commemoration was in general too reflective. I know that sounds paradoxical. It wasn't looking towards the future enough. And I think that we're at a critical moment where we need to be resetting our sights, and we need to be focused about where we're going. So the in addition to that, the march, in remembering the march in 63, there is this demythologizing that has to happen, and not enough of that took place this week, this past week, and I think that the march, I mean, people continue to refer to it as Dr. King's March. I was on a few interviews where people would say, you know, Dr. King's March. Well, no, it wasn't Dr. King's March. He was one of the speakers. He was not the principal organizer of the march. He gave a speech that history remembers, and actually it remembers only part of that speech and not the entirety of the speech. And the entire speech was really quite powerful. So I think that there were some real challenges in the way that this was conceptualized.
Well, indeed, on this Labor Day, Bill Fletcher, Jr., I mean, we could think about, I think, and you have written about this, about divorcing civil rights from economic justice, which appears to have been happening here in terms of the commemoration, and so much of the original commemoration was, and so much of Martin Luther King's speeches were about economic justice. And my sense is that we in this country have so much more in common across the racial lines than we have that divides us, if we think in terms of economic justice, or more accurately, in terms of economic justice, where we are in a country where we have a bunch of plutocrats who've captured our politics and who control our economy.
Well, you know, I think that we have two problems. Social movements have these two problems, and they're recurring. We have economic justice movements that frequently ignore race and gender, and we have movements around race and gender that frequently ignore economic justice. So what's interesting about the origins of the March on Washington in 63 is that the origins of this flow from black labor. It was the Negro American Labor Council that originally conceptualized a March on Washington And their argument, this was an organization that was led by A. Philip Randolph, and their argument was that there was this discussion around civil rights, constitutional rights, but that there was insufficient attention to this growing economic crisis that was afflicting the black workers. So they wanted to have this march, which was originally going to be in October of 1963. When King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference found out about it, they decided to fuse their efforts. And thus we had the August 28th March on Washington of 1963. But the problem recurs that at different points there are these victories, very important ones, in the realm of civil and constitutional rights, but the struggle around economic justice wasn't linked to that. And this is a point, as you said, King always recognized, but he especially after 1965-66 started to rethink strategy and the whole notion of a poor people's campaign, a poor people's march, reflected the sense that the energy of what had been called the civil rights movement needed to be refocused in a way that better linked racial justice with the issue of economic justice and human, and global justice for that matter.
Now, is there a paradox here, Bill Fletcher Jr., in another paradox, since we're talking about paradoxes, that we have a black president and a black attorney general, and we just had the Supreme Court under Justice John Roberts strike down the Voting Rights Act from 1965, the preclearance part of that act that prevented much of the voter suppression that we've witnessed, and now, of course, it's open season on voter suppression, particularly in the South, that in these states that were normally required to pre-clear, and they've jumped out of the gate right away with voter suppression laws. So we know what the results have been, but the rationale for John Roberts and the conservatives on that court was that we don't have any problems anymore. It's all been healed. That, you know, the civil rights movement has succeeded. So is that a problem here, where you have white conservatives telling us civil rights have succeeded and therefore we don't have to do anything? I mean,
yes. What's interesting about their decision is that they didn't. It's sort of like Humpty Dumpty says, "Words mean what I want them to mean, nothing more or less." So it's when you look at the Supreme Court's decision around voting rights, what the majority basically said was that you have to prove that these states are still problematic. Now, that sounds reasonable, except in the hearing, it was proven. The advocates for the voting rights had loads of information and data about the types of problems that exist when it comes to total voter enfranchisement. The Supreme Court majority chose to ignore that. So they basically worded things in a way that anyone that's not doing any research might say, well, that seems like a reasonable position, when in reality what they were doing was striking this blow against voting rights and making it that much more difficult. Now, part of what that means is that when we go forward, it's not just about, you know, trying to get the Congress to revise the act. Between now and whenever the Congress changes, we're going to have to do massive voter registration. We have to make sure that everyone has the proper identification, et cetera. We have to anticipate further voter suppression efforts. But that said, what, and this goes full circle to the issue of the commemoration of the march, I would put to you that that we should be focusing now on the necessity for a third Reconstruction. And, you know, when you think about the period of Reconstruction after the Civil War, it was an attempt to move this country towards a genuine democracy. There were major advances, and they were beaten back by a wealthy clique in the South in its alliance with industrial capitalists in the North. And we went for years in a very repressive situation. Then the 1950s, 1960s emerges, And it's often referred to as a second Reconstruction. Great legislation passed on racial justice, on gender, on a number of things. There were expansions on democracy. And then there was a pushback. Some of the same forces that were pushing back in the 19th century pushed back again. And this time it's called the white backlash or the male backlash or both. And we have been fighting this defensive battle ever since. What I think we have to understand is that we can't keep fighting on the defensive. We have to reset our sights. And our sights need to be set on a notion of a third Reconstruction, where we push through a fight around consistent democracy and expansion on voting rights rather than contraction, rather than being defensive. A fight around the environment and the survivability of the human species, the taking on of this vast polarization of wealth, in fact, fighting to democratize the economy. We need a third Reconstruction. And what one would have hoped would have been that the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the 1963 March would have been essentially a clarion call for a movement towards a third Reconstruction.
And again, Bill Fletcher Jr. is a longtime Labour, racial justice, and international activist. He is on the editorial board and a columnist for blackcommentator.com and a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organised Labour and a New Path Towards Social Justice. So on this Labour Day weekend, Bill Fletcher Jr., in terms of a third Reconstruction, doesn't it make more sense, though, to make it across racial lines, given that Latinos are the fastest growing demographic and their votes are going to be suppressed as much, and that in economic terms, poor whites represent the majority of those living in poverty and on food stamps. So it seems to me that the left in this country can't fall into the trap that the right uses racial division as a subtext to divide and conquer. There's no question, for example, to my mind, that this Republican war on Obamacare is driven by the racist implication that you poor white people are going to be subsidizing a bunch of lazy blacks and Hispanics. That's the message they're selling. Don't you think we on the left have to have a different and much more inclusive and, frankly, more subtle message?
We absolutely do. It's not just cross-racial. I think that the framework that Jesse Jackson raised in the mid-'80s, mid to late 80s, of a rainbow coalition is precisely right. We need to think in terms of building a majoritarian bloc to transform this country. And that's precisely what we need to be doing. And so when I'm thinking about a third Reconstruction, don't get me wrong, I'm not thinking about just simply what happens to African Americans. But what I would say is that when African Americans have been on the move, democracy has expanded in this country. You know, the fight against slavery, the fight against to move Reconstruction, the period from the 1930s through the early 70s, you know, and the African American impulse there, it expanded democracy. And so I think that we African Americans have a pivotal role to play, but we can't do this ourselves, and we have to have a message, a story that actually talks about the necessity for the majority of the people in this country, the people that work, the people that want to work, that need to work in order to live, as opposed to the plutocrats, as you said, the necessity for them to come together to change this country in its fundamentals. That's what King understood. His Poor People's Campaign and the Poor People's March was not a march asking for pity and charity. He was actually looking for a movement that would transform the very essence of this country. And we need to pick up where he left off.
And do you see that happening, or what do you see, Bill Fletcher Jr., as the
core organizing principle around that. Frankly, when I try to cover what's going on in Washington, the one refrain that I get constantly, no matter what the issue I'm covering, comes back to campaign finance, because the plutocrats have bought the Congress, and that's why they leave no billionaire behind, and the rest of us are getting shafted. So that's the reality that we have in America today. What would you consider to be the core organizing principle on this Labor Day of a third Reconstruction?
Well, I distinguish between the core organizing principle and the core issues. So I'd say that the core organizing principle is that we need to build a majority that transforms this country, that no one group can do it by itself, that no one group can fight for the best terms for itself and leave everyone else behind. That, to me, is the core principle of where we go. And related to that is that we are currently divided. We should have no illusions about that. We, meaning the people at the bottom, the bottom 90%, we are divided. We are badly divided. And so what we have to do is we have to fight to unite. And I say that because there's a lot of people that say, well, we have to be careful about the issues we raise. We don't want to raise divisive issues. And usually what they mean by that is we don't want to talk about race. We don't want to talk about gender and things along those lines. And I would argue in response that, no, we're already divided. What we have to figure out is how do we unite? So the second piece is, what are some of the core issues? And I'd say that there are several areas that we have to really look at. One is the environmental catastrophe. Will humanity make it out of the 21st century civilized or in caves? That's the basic question. A second thing, the polarization of wealth and the lack of democracy when it comes to the economy. The third thing is the inequality that exists at the racial and ethnic level. And what does that mean? And finally, the issue of gender. And are we going to take a stand against what I've called political misogynism, this incredible attack on women, this attack on lesbians, gays, the LGBTQ? Do we take a stand for that? And all of this ultimately falls under the rubric of, we need to be building a movement for consistent democracy, the expansion of democracy, as opposed to just resisting the attacks or fighting for piecemeal reforms.
Well, Bill Fetcher, I very much appreciate you joining us here on this Labor Day weekend. It's been a very interesting discussion, and I thank you for it.
Thank you. It's just an absolute pleasure. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Bill Fletcher Jr., a longtime labor, racial justice, and international activist. He's an editorial board member and columnist for blackcommentator.com and a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. Bill Fletcher Jr. is the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor, and A New Path Towards Social Justice. And he has an article at the Zinn Education Project, Claiming and Teaching the 1963 March on Washington. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.